What does it mean to be worldly minded? Well, in the past few weeks, we've been talking quite a bit about the mind in our sermons. A few weeks ago, I asked the same question about the term spiritually minded. What does it mean to be spiritually minded? And as we discussed then, we noted that that is not just a real easy definition to come up with. The things we may think may not be quite complete enough. And when we ask ourselves as Christians, are we spiritually minded? Our first thought is to say, yes, of course we are. Yet as we get into that definition, we may have some questions about it. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about having the mind of a worshiper. What does it mean to be worshipfully minded? Well, this morning we come to the idea of being worldly minded. And like those other two, it's not a terribly easy term to define. And even as Christians, if we're asked that question, our first reaction is, are you worldly minded? We'll say, of course not. I'm a Christian. Yet an examination of our life will tell us whether or not we really are or not. Whether or not our mind is on the things of the world. And so this morning, what I'd like for us to talk about is this idea in relation to salvation. Because salvation belongs only to those who do not have a worldly mind. So this morning, let's discuss what that means and how we achieve that idea of not having that type of mindset. Well, we begin with the idea, first of all, of what it means to be worldly minded. So let's begin to build a definition here. If we want to start really with the easiest part of this, we say that a worldly mind is a mindset that has little to no interest in the things of heaven. It has little to no interest in spiritual matters of pleasing God. That just simply is not on the radar screen. And so if that's the case, this is a mindset that does not think in terms of eternity. To be worldly minded is the idea of the concentration on the here and now. What is my life like now? What affects me now? What do I need to do next in this life? Isn't it interesting that God spent an entire book of the Bible defining that idea for us? When we look at the book of Ecclesiastes, here is a treatise on the idea of what a worldly mind is all about. And so I choose just one verse to show us this idea where the writer says, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. The writer says, you go through this life and you're concerned about physical things, you're concerned about your reputation, you're concerned about the things of the future, you're concerned about the things that you want, and he says, when you get to the end of the road, you're going to look and you're going to see it's meaningless and worthless because you've missed entirely what this life is about. That's the Ecclesiastes writer when he comes up with this idea of what worldliness is all about. So let's set that as our base. Here is our base definition, a mind that is not terribly concerned about spiritual things. Now, what I'd like to do is to build on that idea using three New Testament passages that demonstrate the concept of worldliness and our relationship to it and what that means. The first passage is going to deal with the idea of conformity when it comes to worldliness. And so, Romans chapter 12, verse 2, the Apostle Paul says, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect." And we kind of dealt with the last part of that verse in our lesson on being spiritually minded. I want you now to focus on the first part. Do not be conformed to this world. What do we add to our definition? Here is something that's going to bring us into some type of conformity with the standard. You know, when you think about this idea, one of the areas where we can see this demonstrated is actually in the life of one of our presidents. Herbert Hoover gets a bad rap historically because he was president during a time when the economy just collapsed. He's one of those men, had he never been president, he probably would have died with a much better reputation. He was an engineer. And we know what engineers are like, right? They want everything done by a standard. One of the things that drove Herbert Hoover crazy was he would look, and in some industry, there'd be 5 or 6 or 10 different standards. One in particular that really got under his skin was bricks. He said, you can go, you can find bricks this big or this big or this big. Well, you know, one of the things that Herbert Hoover is not really recorded for very often is he brought conformity to much of our building projects. He decided, okay, this needs to be the standard. And the idea is, if you make a brick, this brick is going to be this big, and it's going to be this wide, and it's going to have this depth. Okay, we understand that idea of conformity. Now let's take that idea to something a whole lot more serious than building material. Because when we think about worldliness, it's the idea of conforming, of setting a standard where you match up with those who have very little interest or no interest in the things of God. So the apostle says, do not conform yourself to this. That if you want to have a mind that is transformed, you cannot conform to the standards of this world. Because if you do that, all of the things that relate to godliness are put away. What is worldly mindedness? Worldly mindedness is conforming to a standard where God is not the standard. Let's add to that. Because in the New Testament, we also read of this idea of friendship involving the world. And so as James is writing, he puts it in very strong terms, begins with the concept of cheating on God, and he says, you adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Okay, so it's a mindset of those who aren't very godly. It's conforming to their standards, but it's more than that. It's becoming their friends. And so James says here, if you want to be a friend, decide who that friend's going to be, because if you are a friend of the world, you cannot be a friend with God. There's a story that hit the news this past week that I'm almost afraid to mention for two reasons. I guess the biggest times that I have been in fear of my life is when I've made the statement that I don't think Chick-fil-A is really that great. You find yourself bearing down under the enmity of lots of people. But I will tell you one thing I've always appreciated about Chick-fil-A is their standards. They have not been embarrassed to say, we're going to stay closed on Sunday. We're going to put godliness front and center. This week, a story came out that Chick-fil-A had decided they would stop contributing to a couple of charities that were in support of the homosexual movement. Here's really the reason I hesitate to make this point. Because I wasn't in the boardroom when those decisions were made. They may have very noble reasons for doing it, but the spin on the story was that it was the attempt to kind of establish a reputation for this company that's tolerant and friendly with everybody. Well, if that's the case, I've got some advice for Chick-fil-A. You'll never be able to do it. In fact, no sooner had that story broke than one of the most outspoken advocates came out and said, it's all fake, they're just being hypocrites, try to get us to turn our attention away from it. You see, you can't be friends with the world and God. You'll never be able to go far enough. And my point is not to come down on Chick-fil-A or to do anything of that nature. It's to look at that and to learn the example that if I say, okay, I'm going to be a friend of God, but I'm also going to keep my foot in the world. I'm going to be a friend with the world. James says, you're cheating on God. You're an adulteress. It can't happen. You're one way or you're the other. So what have we got? Standard that has very little interest in godliness. Conforming to the standards of those who have no interest in Him. Being a friend to those who would put us at enmity with God. But you see, this relationship with the world progresses, and so we find that it's not only the compromising of values. God says what that's going to do is to completely eliminate my relationship with you. Let's follow what we find in the book of James when he says in verse 5, "Or do you suppose it is to no purpose that the Scripture says he yearns jealously over the Spirit that he has made to dwell in us?" God says, I want you to get this down. That if you try to conform to the standards of those who do not respect me, you are not my friend. And he lays it on the line. He says, I'm not going to take second place. I'm not going to play second fiddle to these things of the world, because I put this Spirit in you and I'm jealous for that Spirit, just as a man is jealous for his wife. He doesn't want other men giving her attention. He doesn't want her giving attention to other men. He says, you are mine, and if you do not accept that, you are not my friend. Which leads us to the ultimate then. Conforming and becoming friends, and ultimately loving the world. And thus the Apostle John comes out again in terms as strong as those of James, and he says, do not love the world or the things of the world. You see the progression? Kind of a casual interest, a friendship, and then full out love. John says, don't love the world. Fortunately for us, John defines that for us. He says, look, here are the things that are a danger to you. And he starts out by saying, the lust of the flesh. What are we talking about there? Well, here are the things of a physical nature that God has said, I have reserved for marriage, but if you love the world, you don't keep that standard. This is where fornication comes from. It's a love of the world. To have a relationship of a sexual nature with someone outside of marriage, John says, is a love of the world. It's the lust of the flesh. Here is why one spouse cheats on the other, who takes that relationship that God has given to husband and wife and uses it in such a way to bring this lust of the flesh into the forefront. Let me also add with that, this is where pornography comes from. This idea that you may not be intimately involved with another human being right there in front of you, but you're allowing your mind to be filled with images and scenes that create this lust, and typically what happens? What's the next step? It's a person. It's cheating on a spouse. It's committing fornication. Thus, John says, okay, let me help you understand what the love of the world is. The love of the world is looking at something, this lust of the flesh, and desiring something God has said is not my standard. But he continues. He says also it's the lust of the eyes. And so here he includes this lack of restraint. Some people say it's when our wanters get out of tune. Everything we see, we want. Rampant materialism. It's kind of a dangerous time of year to be talking about that, isn't it? When we encourage our children, okay, create these lists and whatever you want, write down on this list. John says, if we do not have restraint, then what happens is we begin to love the world stuff. And so our lives are defined by the size of the house, the horsepower of the car, the numbers in a bank account. That's what makes us us. He says, if you get there, you've fallen in love with the world. You are out of love with God. You are an adulteress. You're cheating on the one who put this Spirit in you. What a danger for us. A people who are so materially blessed that in many times we can sit in our computer and punch a button and the next day whatever we want is on our front porch. I tell you what, it doesn't take long to fall in love with that, does it? I think materialism is perhaps one of the most dangerous sins for American Christians because it is so mind-numbing. We get into it and we don't realize we're in it. John says you better wake up. He says, that's worldliness. And then he adds one more, and I've chosen a rather odd word here. but I think one that captures the idea the best, and that's the vaunting, the building up of life. John says, if you think you know it all, you're worldly. You think you've got all the answers to every situation? If you build houses, if you buy cars, not just to satisfy yourself, but to impress everybody else, he says, you're in love. You've given your allegiance to the world. You see, that passing interest turns into a friendship that turns into a love affair. And God says, when you cheat on me, I'm not staying with you. So let's take that definition, put it all together. And what we would see then is that worldliness is this mindset of comfortably fitting in with the values and the standards of those who are not very godly. That's what it's all about. It's the idea, I'm going to practice my Christianity so quietly no one will ever guess I'm a Christian. That's what worldliness is. Now, let's move that in a new direction. How does this correspond with the idea of conversion? A problem oftentimes is we believe ourselves to be converted to Christ when we've left not all of worldliness behind. So let me cut to the chase here. That's actually impossible. To be partially converted. Now, I'm not saying that there may be temptations we've got to overcome, but the idea that I'm going to have a little bit of God and a little bit of the world, that just doesn't work. You see, some of self and some of thee may be a process on the road to salvation, but it is not the final destination. Borrowing the language of James once again, as he talks about a double-minded man, he says you can't depend on him because he's unstable in every way. You can't have a part of the world and you can't have a part of God. Spiritually, mindedness is all-encompassing. It's all-included. If you've ever studied psychology, you know that the early stages of psychology dealt with something called phrenology. And that was the concept that by the bumps on your head, you could find out what a person was really like. And the concept behind that was that every little part of the brain dealt with a specific topic. So you can see some of these early diagrams, and you'll see a head, and it'll be divided up as far as which little parts controlled where. All right, I tell you all that because I'm going to borrow the idea for a minute. Okay, so that's the basis of what we're about to see. Here is our life. We got a place for entertainment. We got a place for work, our money, our family, our hobbies. Someone who seeks to be some of self and some of thee says, well, I've got room in my mind for God. I'm going to give him a little part of it. He's got a spot there. And just like I care for money and I care for my hobbies and I like to be entertained, I'm going to give a space to God. Now let me ask you, is that what conversion's all about? To be converted to something, does it mean to give a little small part? Or does it look something more like this? That yes, while I have my money and my entertainment, my hobbies and my work and my family, everything relates to God. How I spend my money, how I treat my wife, how I treat my husband, how I treat my kids, how I treat my employer, the kinds of things I watch, the kind of hobbies, they all relate back to being a part of God's family. That's what conversion is all about. To simply give God a little peace, some might say would be enough religion to make us happy. I would suggest to you it's enough religion to make us miserable. That we know we're wrong, we're just not willing to change. So then, what does that mean for us? It means that anything less than full godliness is going to put a strain on us that we will never, ever be able to overcome. There's a passage, I believe, that tells us that. As Paul's getting ready to address the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit, he says the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit. The desires of the Spirit are against the flesh, for these are opposed to each other to keep you from doing the things you want to do. He says, you want to be a Christian, but you're letting worldliness dominate. He says, what you're doing is you're putting one enemy against the other. You're putting worldliness up against God. You're putting the flesh up against the Spirit. And he says, these things are enemies. They cannot coexist. They cannot both be controlled. And thus, what that means for us as Christians is that we must realize that when we become a Christian, there is nothing secular in our lives. We sometimes try to draw this distinction. But for a Christian, we don't view anything in a secular way. As we've noted, how my money is spent, how my family is treated, how I work, all of those things are a testimony to whether or not I am converted to God. Thus, God says, while I know this is a lifelong pursuit and you're growing, he says, what I will not tolerate is where you are willingly saying, I'm going to give some of self to you, but I'm going to keep the rest of it for me. With that in mind, let's look at a really important irony. And I'll encourage you to look over to John 17 with me as we see this point being made by the Lord. Very near the time of his crucifixion, he spent a while talking to the apostles, and it seems they're not quite getting it. And he ends that discussion by going to his Father in prayer. And I want you to listen very carefully as we read together, beginning in verse 5. And I want you to note all the references to the world in this. We're going to begin in verse 5, and we'll read down through about verse 18 or so. He says, now, Father, glorify me in your own presence with the glory that I had with you before the world existed. I have manifest your name to the people whom you gave to me out of the world. Yours they were, and you gave them to me, and they have kept your word. Now they know that everything that you have given me is from you. And I have given them the words that you gave me, and they have received them and have come to know the truth that I came from you, and they have believed that you sent me. I am praying for them. I am not praying for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. All mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I am glorified in them. And I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world. And I am coming to you, Holy Father, keep them in your name, which you have given me, that they may be one, even as we are one. While I was with them, I have kept them in your name, which was given me. I have guarded them, and not one of them has been lost except the son of destruction, that the scripture might be fulfilled. But now I am coming to you, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. That's a lot of discussion about the world, isn't it? Now, I want you to note the irony here in association with the apostles. Jesus says the apostles have been taken out of the world so that they may stay in the world. Well, what does that mean? Well, what Jesus explains is that in these 3 years, he has been helping them to transform their minds, to come to a point that although they are in the world, they are not thinking in worldly terms. And Jesus says the entire purpose of this, of taking that worldliness out of them, is so that they can go into the world. For what reason? Well, this should be very, very much in our mindset by now. Because for the past 11 months, we've been talking about the idea of going into all the world to proclaim the gospel to the entire creation. How did the apostles do that? It was by being taken out of the world first. In the sense that Jesus is teaching them what it means to be a child of God, what it means to depend on God and to trust in His care. Thus, I think we need to see the point also, don't we? That like the apostles, the only way I'm going to have any interest in going into all the world is when all the world is out of me. That's going to be my motivation. Because when all of the world is out of you and you get your paycheck, the first thing you think about is what good in the service of the Lord can I do with this money? What is the good that I can do? Can I support someone in preaching the gospel? Can I help a Christian in need? Can I help someone who's having problems? Point number one. I'm not going to have this idea of, well, I can't talk to anybody about the gospel because it might damage our relationship. No, if all the world's out of me, I'm not terribly concerned about those worldly relationships being okay because God comes first. And for certain, I'm going to get that fear out of me that says, well, what will people think of me if I'm somebody who talks about God? You see, like the apostles, I got to come out of the world so I can go into the world. I got to get the world out of me so that I can be a part of it teaching the truth. So it brings it all down to the question, where exactly am I? Spiritually minded, worldly minded, some of self, some of thee, where am I in all of this? Because worldliness is awfully deceptive. If I find myself growing upset and alarmed and losing sleep with every story of political intrigue in this life, I am of the world. If I care more about the President and Congress than I do the Father and the Son, I am of this world. If the ease of this age dulls me to the need for God, if I look at my bank account and my stock holdings and my insurance policies and the deed to my house and the title to my car and I say, soul, eat, drink, and be merry, you've got it covered, I am of this world. And if the myth of my own intelligence says, well, I just can't accept all that about God, I am of this world. You see, answering the question of whether or not I'm worldly minded means I have got to take everything out of the closet and examine it and to see where I truly stand. Because the only ones who are not worldly minded are those whose citizenship is in heaven. That my concern is only for God. Financially, He is prioritized. In the work that I do, it's to His glory. How I treat others is to be a reflection of how He's treated me. When I am of that citizenship, then I have put an end to the things of this world. As we just sung, it's none of self and all of thee. So that's the question that comes to us this morning. Where am I? Am I in the world? From the standpoint of, I share in its friendship, I share in all these things associated with it, or am I in the world to be a light for God? I hope the answer's B. This morning, if you're not a Christian, you know where you are. You know if you've not given your life to God exactly where you are, but that can change. God says, I'll take you out of this world, not in the sense of physical removal, but in the sense of I'll put your citizenship elsewhere, change your priorities, show you what life is to be about. You can do that this morning by accepting His grace, through faith being baptized for the remission of your sins, or if you've allowed those things to so cloud your vision. And we can pray with you about that this morning. We'll do it. Whatever it takes, let's be a people who are not of this world. A people whose citizenship is firmly in heaven.